Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Our guest today is Jack Herrick. Jack is I could consider him a tennis expert, one of probably the major historian on tennis left in this city. You know, because we're getting so old. Jack is 76, as am I, and we are doing this conversation on October 29th, 2014.
Whatever.
October 29th, 2014. And let's begin with we're gonna begin in the early 50s, and then take us right through what we call the Malaga years, when Cleveland was one of the international centers for tennis. And you can interrupt me at any time.
Well, I would say the international city for tennis.
Okay. And my awareness of big time tennis began in the early 50s, when Jack Kramer started the first professional tennis tour. Now, until then, all tennis players were pure amateurs. So now these were tainted professionals.
Right.
Pancho Gonzalez, Pancho Segura, and others. Would you recall, you were a ball boy when the first tennis tournament, when it came through Cleveland, it was played at Lakewood Park.
Correct.
Okay, and now what are your memories of that?
Well, my memories, again, you mentioned, Danny, that you and I are the same age and all that.
Yes.
You're from the West Side. But when that tournament came, it was something, at least for Clevelanders, that was brand new, a big-time men's professional or amateur, whatever you wanted to call it. And they had a draw of about 16 players. I mean,
there were 16 players who turned pro.
As I recall, there were more than eight, I know. So there were, and there may have been more, but they attracted the best tennis players in the United States and outside the United States, too. I think there were one or two Canadians that played that tournament.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd never seen anything like this before, not to mention the ability of the players and some of the real colorful players. You mentioned Jack Kramer. I think, the draw was outstanding, but a lot of them were the type that would be cracking jokes between points, too.
Really?
You don't see that very often these days.
Right. Yeah. They are so deadly serious.
Exactly. Well, of course, they're also playing for several million dollars, too.
Uh-huh.
But I don't recall what the purse was at that time. It was a very popular tournament in a kind of a garden spot in Lakewood, where a lot of picnic tables around there and so forth.
Yes.
And the sport was done correctly in that they had, an umpire in an umpire's chair calling out the score. And they had linesmen, and they had ball boys. And that's where you and I fit in. And we were like, whatever it was, 12, 13, 14 years old, looking at these big-time tennis players. It was, for us, a very inspiring thing.
This was the early 1950, 51, 52, 53, that era.
That's right.
And that is what started the big tennis tours, wasn't it?
Certainly one of them, Yeah, I mean, in those days, they still had the U.S. Open at Forest Hills.
Yes.
And I think they had the French Open, Wimbledon, and so forth and so on. but it was something for greater Cleveland to see.
Yes. But in those days, the Wimbledon and the U.S. Open, they were still purely amateurs.
These guys
were disqualified now from ever playing in one of these major tennis championships.
Right.
Wimbledon for Pancho Segura after he signed with Jack Kramer.
Yeah, for who knows how much.
Right. And where did he get the money to do this?
Exactly.
And how did the revenue come in?
Yeah.
I don't know what it cost to see those tennis tournaments at Lakewood Park. $1, $2, $1.50? I don't know. Because I would ride my Schwinn down there and just look through the fence.
Right. Uh-huh. And I have no recollection either. I do know that all of us were not paid, but then again, when you're 13 years old, why would you be? And then things graduated from there.
Okay.
In the greater Cleveland area, and the emergence of one of the greatest men that in sport, and maybe for lots of reasons, Bob Malaga arrived.
Well, then, about 10 years lapsed from when Jack Kramer's tennis tournament last visited Lakewood Park.
Right.
About 10 years passed, and in 1964, Bob Malaga, an old football player from Cathedral Latin and Michigan State, but also a tennis devotee. And he stole in one of the most remarkable stories in sports, when Bob Malaga stole the U.S. the Davis Cup Finals. Did they call it the Challenge Match, the Finals? But anyway, it was the Davis Cup Finals.
It was called the Challenge Run, the Davis Cup Challenge Run.
Okay. Yeah. Stole it from New York. Stole it from Forest Hills. Those people, when it was over, they were blinking their eyes. What the heck happened?
What happened?
Yes.
They're still saying that, by the way.
How did he do it? Well, because the tennis tournament, the U.S. Open, was always played at Forest Hills, New York.
Correct.
And in fact, we referred to it as Forest Hills, the tennis tournament at Forest Hills, not the U.S. Open, just Forest Hills.
Exactly.
He won Forest Hills.
Right.
Yes. And so, they were just so comfortable in, they never saw it coming.
No.
I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Resume the story.
Well, let me go back a little bit earlier than that. Okay. I believe it was 1962 when Bob got one of the matches between countries leading up to the Challenger.
Okay.
And that was, I believe it was Venezuela. Mm. Played in 1962 and was played at the Cleveland Skating Club.
And this was U.S. against Venezuela?
U.S. against Venezuela in what they call a zone match.
Yes, okay.
And nothing like this had ever happened, and this had a lot of publicity to it. Because it was a big item on the tennis, clearly in playing Davis Cup matches, but it was a big item on the tennis calendar for the year anyhow. So the U.S. won that match, by the way. Mm-hmm. But it was at that time that Bob kind of launched what Cleveland was going to be about. And I will say that he did it with bringing some money to the table. Because the U.S. Tennis Association, as are many of the sports organizations, pretty much nonprofit groups, sure, they need to have capital to put on their shows and so forth and so on. But rather than rely on a city and so forth, he took and he did this later on also, he cobbled together some money with some very people in this community who love to see sports and be a part of sports, and sent the U.S. Tennis Association a check. And I don't know what it was for, but let's just say in those days, let's say it was for $50,000, we want to buy this event for the rights for it and have it here. Well, U.S. Tennis Association never seen anything like that, as I recall. And so we got that match. Mm-hmm. And they sat probably 2,000-3,000 people, mm-hmm. brought in grandstands and so forth.
Now, this was in the parking lot of a junior high.
Well, that was later.
I'm sorry. You're the tennis, skating club, yes.
Right. People like to talk about funny little stories, though. When that match with Venezuela started, the grandstands were up. There were flags flying. Yes. You know, he had one of those Marine groups that will come up.
Yeah,
Star Spangled Banner,
yes,
and so forth.
Yes.
And we're all ready to go. Umpires are in place. Uh-huh. The linesmen, the ball boys. Someone forgot to bring a can of tennis balls. True story. Yeah.
Really?
Everybody looked around and blaming the other person.
No.
Anyhow, so I obviously got that together. But let's come up to the main event, which you were talking about. After another event that next summer.
By the way,
summer,
how did that that zone match with Venezuela draw? Full house at the skating club?
Yeah, but full house wasn't that much by today's standards. But I'd say 2,000-3,000 people.
That many people in the skating club? Wow.
Yeah. Well, they set up grandstands on all four sides, on both sides, and then you got some.
But now, as I recall, those are outdoor courts at the skating club.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And we had rain, we put up with rain when it happens and so forth. Uh-huh. But now to come to the next year, 83. 63, sorry.
Yes.
The United States won the Davis Cup that year.
In 1963.
The challenge round, correct.
Okay. We were world champions.
Yeah, as I recall. So the U.S. had the choice of hosting the challenge round in the next year. I think that year it may have been played in Australia.
Okay.
And so they decided they wanted that next year, 1964, to be in Cleveland. Excuse me, in the United States. Mm-hmm. So Bob Malaga goes up to a bunch of people and says, you know, we're going to make a bid for it. And the rest of the country said, you what? Especially friends from Forest Hills,
yeah,
where every major event has ever been held.
Of course this will be at Forest Hills, yeah. New York, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Bob, that's the most obnoxious comment I've ever heard in my life. Not to be outdone, he at the time had built up the Northeast Ohio Tennis Association, which is one of the many districts of the U.S. LTA at that time, actually U.S. Lawn Tennis Association, and started campaigning. He had also been very dominant in the administrative tennis affairs in the entire Midwest.
Okay.
So after the people finished laughing at Cleveland, yeah, for saying, oh yeah, right, you're going to get the challenge round, he went around and got big support from the Midwest.
So he had alliances. This became a political game, huh?
We got an election coming up in about a week here, just like that.
Really?
And I was fortunate enough to, Bob is 12 years older than I am, so I was, you know, still wet behind the ears and all that. But I learned more at that time about politics, and he knew it. He's the most street smart man I've ever known.
Gee.
At any rate, so he goes and making sure that he has his base in the Midwest covered. Because the ground rules are going to be this. There are three cities that wanted the challenge round. Forest Hills in New York, Cleveland, and the Los Angeles Tennis Club in California, whose chairman was Parry Jones, very dominant in tennis administration. But they only sat about 2,000 people at the LA Tennis Club. So they come now to have a vote. And the ground rules are this. They're going to have a vote, and you vote for who you want to hold the challenge round, New York, Cleveland, or LA. And the low voter will drop out, and you'll now have a vote between number one and two. Well, in the meantime, Bob has also been out to the West Coast and to the East Coast for what it was worth and so forth. But the big key to that was win that first vote. Mm-hmm. Well, I forget who finished first, whether it was New York or Cleveland, but LA finished last. They finished third. So now Bob has cultivated, he's got the Midwest, he's cultivated the West Coast, and he's kind of saying to the West Coast too, by the way, I'm sorry you lost, but you want that back out east again? And all of a sudden, you know, it'd be the best thing for tennis that the challenger on his held.
Okay, what kind of a lapse was there from the first vote to the second vote?
You know, it may even have been the same weekend. I don't recall. I wasn't there where the vote was taken, but I don't believe it was like a couple weeks later.
Yeah.
I think. So, at any rate, Cleveland wins it. And Forest Hills people are saying, what happened?
Yes.
At any rate.
Now, by the way, Bill Nichols, this is 1964. Bill Nichols was covering tennis for the Plain Dealer. And I was at the Plain Dealer at the time.
Yep.
And I can remember Bill, well into an evening, he's sitting there by the phone waiting for the call from Malaga saying, we won.
We got it.
And yes, and it was a very suspenseful night in the sports department of the Plain Dealer.
Absolutely.
That night, as Bill is waiting for the, and it went well into the evening, as
I think it was close to even midnight.
That is right.
Yeah.
That's how I remember it too, yes.
Yeah. So anyhow.
The world was stunned.
Stunned.
Yes.
But hey, bravo Cleveland, bravo Malaga.
So now he has to put it on. Right.
Well. There weren't any problems with that.
Oh.
He had no facility, no courts, no plan, nothing, except another thing he did. He cobbled together and this is in 1963. Actually, three because the event was in 64. But still, $100,000 in a bank account and sent it to the USTA. LTA at that time, but he had no site, he had no structure, so forth and so on, except Bob Malaga, the great, negotiator and doer.
Uh-huh.
First thing he did, because you had mentioned it earlier, he changed the name of the event from the Davis Cup Challenge Round to the Davis Cup World Finals, or even tennis's World Finals, which stuck. I think it's still used today. But, hey, we've seen name changes throughout the years, especially with sports organizations. But there it was. It was a tremendous success. He negotiated with the Roxborough Junior High School.
Yes, that's in Cleveland or Shaker Heights.
Actually, it's in Cleveland Heights.
Okay, Cleveland Heights. Okay.
Right, and you know, they have a nice athletic field and so forth. All of a sudden, he said, "We're gonna. This would be an ideal place to put it because it was well located for as far as east, west, north, south of Greater Cleveland, and put up two courts, one a practice court, but the main grandstand court sat about 7,000 people, as I said, and the event was put on between Australia and the United States. Unfortunately, Australia won it 3-2, as I recall, but it was packed every day.
Yes.
Every seat was sold.
Mm-hmm.
And a Davis Cup match takes 3 days. You play two singles the first day, doubles the second, and two singles matches the third day. And the community just loved it. Couldn't wait to get more of it. From that point on, he did typically
Before we move on,
sure.
Could we move back to the new paint job on the seats?
I keep trying to forget that.
Yeah. Jack, it was in your... Now, you did the eulogy on Bob Malaga when he passed away last year in 2013. And maybe you didn't mention this in the eulogy, but many people at Bob's funeral did. Recalled how he sold more seats than there was room for.
Correct.
So.
I was not the one who told that story at his eulogy. But it was generally went that the place was this was for another event. I don't think it was the.
Oh, it was
Davis
not
Cup
that's
finals.
Not what
no,
it was.
No, it was a later. But
then we'll come back to.
No. Well, it's still. Okay. I mean, the story is terrific in that. He realized that so many people were coming to these tennis matches. He sat there as he would with a cigar and maybe even a little libation on the side. But he said, well, you know, if we eliminate those seats over there, we could then open up another aisle and so forth and just pack in a lot more seats.
Uh-huh.
And rather than, let's say, having per seating place getting eight there, maybe we could just trim an inch here and then get nine at every one.
Uh-huh.
So everybody was happy and someone had to exchange some seats and some tickets and so forth and so on. But the match, whatever match it was, again, tremendous success and so forth. And one of his friends who had been sitting there, I recall, with a suit on and just come from the office said, Bob, you put on another great event. I just love it. But this crazy thing, I've got this brown kind of a patch on my suit pants that I can't figure out. It's kind of sticky. It's almost like it's paint. And he said, oh, gee, we had to do some painting or so forth and so on, and I maybe just didn't dry. I mean, I don't remember the whole answer. But the fact of the matter was what they did, they came in about 3 in the morning and made this switch and painted the new seats so you could tell who
painted
was sitting.
Painted new seats and new seat numbers on them.
Something like that.
To squeeze another seat in every row.
Yeah.
And it's all fresh paint.
Exactly.
And he didn't tell anybody.
Yeah, but it should have dried in that 6 hours or whatever. So
people left with paint on. Once again, I interrupted you.
No,
I'm sorry.
No. But so went on. Bob hosted about, four or five Whiteman Cup matches.
Yes.
Which were between England and the United States.
Those were thrilling.
Yes.
Well,
you saw the virtually the debut of Chris Evert.
That's right.
Who Bob, she was about 16. And
that's right.
Bob said, watch this girl. She's really going to be good. Well, we kind of said, what are you talking about? She just came here to Cleveland. She played 3 matches. And I think one of them was 6-2, 6-1. The other 6-3, 6-1. I mean, she won 6 straight sets, I think. Oh. Very low scores. What do you mean, watch it? That's fairly obvious, Bob. You are a predictor of who's going to be good and so forth and so on. But anyway, she did go on to, obviously, a spectacular career.
That's right.
But there were...
And it started here in Cleveland with her.
At only 16, she hadn't played a lot of tournaments.
Yes.
And he created another event, if you remember, Yvonne Goolagong from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Evert from the United States, they were about the same era.
That was a big match, those two.
Well, what typical Bob, what he did, he created a country match, the United States versus Australia.
He did.
And talked to the Bonnie Bell people, and it was called the Bonnie Bell Cup.
Oh, that's right, the Bonnie Bell Cup.
And it was all built around that one match.
Uh-huh.
And it was terrific.
Yes.
Because the women really drew here too. That was another nice mm-hmm. thing about it. These weren't just men's matches.
That's right.
We had again four Whiteman Cups, the Bonnie mm-hmm. Bell, and there may have been one other.
I can remember Hal Lebovitz writing a big column in the Plain Dealer saying he enjoyed watching women's tennis more than men's tennis.
Yep.
Because men's tennis, bam, 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 point.
Right.
Women's tennis, back and forth. He found it more enjoyable to watch, and it was.
Intriguing.
Especially Yvonne Goolagong and Chris Everett.
Yeah.
But Chris Everett was the new sweetheart of tennis.
As was Yvonne.
And Goolagong,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So he created that event.
That is terrific.
I don't remember who the other three or four players on the Australian or U.S. teams were.
Right.
Probably very
well,
good players.
Well, America, we probably had, would we have had Billie Jean King around that time? Or
she was maybe past her prime at that time a little bit, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, but whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. So the big one, the world finals.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there were four of them here. Australia twice, and that was played at the convention center here. You know, the auditorium, the indoors.
Mm-hmm. Because it was played in the winter?
Yes, it was as I recall, kind of November-ish, where you didn't want to take a chance on uh-huh. playing outside.
Yeah.
It's just not warm enough. But what a career it was. And then it was kind of getting started, because what happened is Bob was practicing law here, mm-hmm. and he was a political figure. I mean, he was a real confidant of Jim Rhodes, while he was governor, and then he held a couple of positions himself. He was common pleas judge. He was the probate court judge, and he held another court.
He was a judge in the city of Cleveland Municipal Court.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. And he had a number of different things that he was into.
Yes.
But the USTA, after seeing, again, I got to remember, still the United States Lawn
yes.
Tennis
okay.
Association at that time, you know, wanted him to come to New York, and they wanted him to start working for USSR for U.S. tennis. So
really,
yeah. So he became, up to that time, the so-called executive director, kind of the guy who's responsible, was pretty much always a volunteer position. He became the first full-time paid executive of U.S. tennis.
Really?
Yeah. And he was in New York about half the week mm-hmm. and back here in his beloved Cleveland the other mm-hmm. half of the week. And he was that for about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, his 24 hours a day is devoted to packing in some financial punch
really?
Into the U.S. Tennis Association, mm-hmm. and he was the first one ever. Think about it. He was the first one ever to negotiate a clothing contract. You know, to have T-shirts that say U.S. Tennis Association.
Really?
So that kind of a thing, shirts and T-shirts and just stuff like that. How big is it today?
Yeah,
probably wouldn't want to know, Dan.
He was a visionary, all right.
A visionary. And he made other commercial deals, uh-huh. getting sponsors for tournaments in return for advertising and the title sponsorship and so forth and so on, and brought tennis into the commercial world. And again, look at tennis today.
Yes.
And he did that again for about 6-7 years. I'm trying to remember where that would take him age-wise, but... But he came back to Cleveland, and I know he had his judgeships after that. I think.
Okay.
Again, there were three of them.
Well, then there was a time when, near the end of Cleveland's run, we built tennis courts in the municipal parking lot down here.
You're right.
And that didn't work out because of the noise, among other things, the noise of the traffic and the trucks going down the shoreway. It was sort of disconcerting.
It was. I think there's some other things that were happening then, too, though, is that...
We're talking now 1970s, are we? Late 70s?
Probably late 70s.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just about right. Because I think the last challenge round against the indoor one I referred to mm-hmm. against Australia was in 76 or 70, right about in there. And by the way, other cities now in that, there's a span of close to 20 years.
Okay.
Other cities were learning how to get Davis Cup matches, whether yes. they're inner zone matches or the finals or whatever.
Suddenly the secret was out.
Oh, yeah.
Malaga taught them. They paid attention.
Absolutely. And they were building, you know, concrete stadiums that would sit 12, 15,
really?
8,000 people, whatever. Those are very expensive. I mean, now you've got a real, permanent setting for that in the future. And we tried to do that here, and it almost did happen, by the way, but it didn't. So in the meantime, these tennis events that he always put on here were easily manageable events in that Davis Cup, for example, only has 5 players on a team. So there are only 10 players. So, you know, just taking care of them and so forth and so on is a lot easier, as opposed to bringing in a tournament where, let's say, you may have 70 or 80 competitors. But he wanted to try that. And Roxborough Junior High School did not have enough courts. So he went to downtown, and courts were put up in the municipal parking lot in Lakeshore Drive.
Yes.
And it made a lot of sense, because they weren't utilized as much for parking as they had hoped at the time. But what happened, and I'll use this term, where those matches were before, with just a few people involved,
right.
and matches between countries,
yes.
which also have to
yes.
do with national pride and
right.
so forth,
yes.
and there are only 5 matches that were played,
uh-huh.
and people really got close to that,
yes.
closeness to the team and the players
yes.
and all
That's
that.
Right.
And it was in a nice neighborhood, again, Cleveland Heights, easily
yes.
accessible from all the other,
yes.
all the, again, east, west, south.
It had charm.
Cleveland. Charm, is that. And that is what was missing, I think, with the tournament downtown.
Yes.
Which, because it had, let's just say, a 32 draw with qualifying and all that, started on Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody was going to go to a tennis match on Monday morning to see a qualifying match.
Yes.
Or the first round on Tuesday at 11 or whatever, and then build up to the semis and the finals over the weekend. They weren't going to come out there every day to see it. Whereas the Davis Cup and the Whiteman Cup, they'd come all those 3 days if they could. And they might have to miss one. They'd be sad about it. But it was just automatic that we were going to the tennis matches. So I think, and it never got much better either. And I also think the location wasn't as central. Again, as Nick Mulledy said, half your crowd lives north of here. I mean, does not live north of here because it's Lake Erie.
Yes,
you know, that's, and it just kind of left, and it's hard to put it together, and especially so it was in a sense the end of an era,
mm-hmm.
and what a golden, jubilant era it was.
But it lasted about 10 years or so.
Well, about 20.
Okay.
Again, the first tournament was in 62. The last one was about 77. Well, that's 15 years. But,
okay.
Trying the tournament downtown, it almost spanned 20 years.
Okay.
And not that Cleveland is an unimportant
mm-hmm.
tennis mecca in the United States. It is still very important. It just doesn't have the pizzazz that those events brought in. And I would say that during that run, too, I think the most telling phrase of what Cleveland meant internationally, because, you know, this town has always had a great orchestra, and people would go around the world and say, you know, Cleveland is best known for 2 things, tennis and its orchestra. And it was true. And you'd go to foreign countries and they, aren't you from Cleveland? Isn't that where all those Davis Cup matches or Whiteman Cup matches are being played?
Wow.
So it took on real international significance,
which
was great also. He was something, and I'm not sure there will ever be another one like him.
No.
He was very unique.
Yes. Wouldn't that be something to leave your mark, a legacy like that?
Yep. But,
well, that's gone forever, probably. Like the 6-day bike races and all of that, you know.
Yeah.
I
used to love those, by the way.
Did?
My dad would take me down.
Really?
Oh, yeah. But go ahead.
Well, you know, over the years, we've had so many different sporting eras here. For example, we had the the slow pitch softball era lasted about 20 years. That was a frenzy. That was a fad. Every bar was a supported a softball team. That finally ran its course. Other things, we used to have a big pro golf tournament here in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Every year, the Cleveland Open.
Right.
And this one on must have lasted 25 years, maybe a little longer. Now there's the one in Firestone that goes on and on.
Yep.
That may go on forever. We don't know. But we've experienced so many of those, like the six-day bike races at the old Cleveland Arena, the Golden Gloves boxing tournaments.
Yep.
That used to have hundreds of entries. Now they might get 50 entries in the Golden Gloves boxing tournament. Eras come and go. There was Thistledown once had some big races, horse races. Not so much anymore. Barely hanging on by its fingernails. Yeah, so what's the next big thing in Cleveland, I wonder?
Athletic-wise?
Yeah. Oh, and the auto race.
Oh, yeah.
We had the auto race for about, I'll never forget. I broke the story in the Plain Dealer that Cleveland was getting this big auto race. And I was just beside myself with joy. 1981, I'm covering the Indianapolis 500 and picked up this word that, what? There's going to be a race here in Cleveland.
Right.
And so I wound up, I started working the phones from my hotel room in Indianapolis and found that, yes, it's going to be at Burke Lakefront Airport. Didn't have all the details, but that story was that Sunday morning, top story on page one of the Plain Dealer. Auto race is coming to Cleveland. I thought this was so charming. This will be sort of like Monaco. I'd been to the race in Monaco. You know, here on the lakefront and the cars racing by, this is going to be charming. But once again, it might have lasted 15 years or so. Now that's gone and probably forever. You know, the venue on the Lakefront Airport venue was just, it was tough to work. It was tough. Everything was tough about it.
Yep. By the way, it's one of my favorite sports to visit is IndyCars in particular.
Uh-huh.
And to this day, when you talk to a lot of the drivers, they still say that their favorite course was Cleveland.
Is that right?
Yes. Because it did have that element of, you know, you've got a lake in the background and it was a good course and it was a driver's course where
had 12 turns or 13 turns or whatever.
Right.
Yes.
But in usually in the summer, July, when the weather basically was just sun and the whole thing, and again the lake background and the best drivers in the world running that circuit. So they when I see some of them, they say, you know, is Cleveland going to bring that back? But you know, Dan, I think that there's a common denominator in all the kinds of things you just cited. And eventually, in the case of tennis being held in Cleveland, is that so much has to do with a four-letter word that begins with C and ends with H. C-A-S-H, yes. And it, by the way, is that not existent in any other type of thing you're talking about? It does. And let's take the tennis. Bob Malaga was far ahead of his time with tennis in the greater Cleveland area. And he went ahead and did it. And as the rest of the world watched him have this tremendous career, and who was one of the great beneficiaries of it? The people of Cleveland.
Yes.
But eventually, they built permanent concrete stadiums. That's one thing we didn't have. Ours was still as temporary. They built that, which involves a lot of cash. And they got people interested and organizations willing to put up the prize money and so forth and so on. And Cleveland didn't have that. Eventually, I'll put it this way, Cleveland did have it. Cleveland eventually got replaced by other organizations with different facilities and more permanent facilities. Mm-hmm. And I will say, with the lakefront, going back to the automobile racing analogy you just said, that was not a permanent stadium.
Yes.
It's there actually, among other things, by the grace of the federal government, the aviation
FAA, Federal Aviation, whatever.
So we've gotten passed by, and we haven't been able to raise as much cash as we would like either for that IndyCar race. But I'm off the subject again.
But
there is a trend there.
Yes. Well, now let's look at this trend. Cleveland is a shrinking city.
That's correct.
Now, for the metropolitan area here, we're just as big as we were 30, 40 years ago, but no bigger. Other cities, they're growing. They've passed us up growth. We haven't shrunk, really, but we've stayed the same. Other cities have grown up more. They seem to just have more people and more cash.
Yep. And some cities annex the cities next to them, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
For example, Columbus. Yes. Now the area of Columbus is huge. I believe you're right, it's very small. But,
look through the decades. Florida, southwest Arizona, those areas.
Yeah. Weather is better. You can count on it more often for outdoor events like tennis matches and golf matches and automobile racing.
There was a
like
time
that.
Back in the 60s when Cleveland talked about getting the Pan Am Games here.
Yes.
And that thinking went back to when the Cleveland Municipal Stadium was built, 1930-31. We were dreaming of perhaps getting the 32 Olympics here, which they wound up in Los Angeles.
Right.
But so we built this 80,000-seat monster of a stadium, and really it sat mostly idle until middle of the 46 baseball season, or 47 season, when Bill Beck moved the Indians in there permanently.
Mm-hmm.
And but we were, at that time, Cleveland thought big, dreamed big, planned big, built an 84,000-seat stadium for in case we get the Olympics. Well, didn't get them, but that's how we were dreaming at one time. And then we still talked. Remember, as I mentioned, get the Pan Am Games here during the 60s. Well, that I don't think that happened either. But there was a time when we thought big here.
All right. Well, let's even get a little bit broader on this.
Okay.
Cleveland is going through a real renaissance now.
Okay.
I'm fortunate to be involved with the Downtown Cleveland Alliance, and so I'm seeing a lot of that firsthand. And from round figures, we have almost 15,000 new young people living in downtown Cleveland. By the way, when we started this, I think it was supposed to be about sports, by the way.
Yes, well, no, about the tennis era here.
Correct. But just
young people?
What the?
Young people could be anything under 75 compared to you and me.
Well, then let's make it under 77,
okay.
And we'll be the young. But Cleveland has a bright future, I believe. And it can use more and so forth, but there are a lot of brains, good, solid brains, at work in this town, young, old, whatever you want to call it, that are putting things together. And I think I'd like to think the days, better days for Cleveland are ahead, including those in the world of sport.
Okay, Jack. And by the way, we haven't really touched on you personally, that you were once a world champion squash player, squash sort of like racquetball, and you once owned the 13th Street
Sports club.
So do you still play much squash? Do you really?
Well, not as much. It's kind of hard now. I play once a week.
Do you?
I work out virtually every day.
At age 76, you do all that.
Yes. It's ingrained in a sense. But the answer, I try and stay active.
Uh-huh.
And I'm still having a circus.
Okay, you once played hockey. But now here's another thing. We once had hockey. Well, we still have a hockey team.
Correct.
No one talks about it. I think that they actually draw fairly well.
They draw very well.
Because they got very little attention in the newspaper.
Correct.
But nobody... I hear nobody talking about them on the street or on the radio, the talk shows and television, never there, but people go.
Yes, they do.
Sometimes there's a little an undercurrent, things that are happening, but the media sort of misses. That may be something that the media is not necessarily intentionally ignoring, but just missing. They're not paying attention. As an old hockey player, you probably would have a sense for that would perk up your ears. But hockey, now we're just not observing things like we used to years ago.
Of course things have changed too.
Yes.
And I don't know whether this is correct or not, but I think that only having newspapers
I know they come out 7 days a week, but having our only now major newspaper not coming out seven times a week for a homeowner is not helping things.
That's, I agree.
But the newspaper business has its own also cash interests and hills they have to climb and so forth, and they feel that that's the way it has to be, at least for the greater Cleveland area at this time. But I have difficulty in waking up Monday morning wanting to get the inside review on why the Browns won or lost, and it isn't there at my breakfast plate on Monday morning.
Yes.
But time marches on. The world of communication I do not understand now, as my children and grandchildren keep reminding me.
Uh-huh. Well, I know it's hard to eat your breakfast and read the baseball box scores on a computer screen. It doesn't work. Yeah. But now we've seen so many different eras. We've touched about the tennis era here, and we both remember fondly our auto race era. There was, and before that, we had the stock car races at Cloverleaf Speedway.
And midgets also.
Yes.
Midget cars.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and by the way, they did have midget car races at the old stadium, too.
Yes, they did.
Yes.
Yep.
So we've seen so many things, and we recall every year the Cleveland Open golf tournament when the biggest stars were here for a week.
Yeah.
All those things. Boy, what a life we've had. You know, when you look back on it, we've been exposed. We had a chance to see so many different things in this town.
Yes.
Now our children just flick on the television set, and they've got 20 college football games every Saturday to watch. You see, you experience things in just a different way. We've made some short-sighted decisions here. When we built the new Brown Stadium on the lakefront, did not put a roof on it. Had they taken just a little while longer and thought this thing out, they'd have put a roof on that stadium, we would be in the rotation to host the Big Ten championship game every fourth year. Look at how many domed stadiums we have for college football in the Big Ten area. We've got Detroit, we've got Minneapolis, we've got Indianapolis, and that's it. Those three cities will rotate the Big Ten championship game every year. Not only if we had put a roof on this thing, and we had the chance, we've got the newest stadium in the Big Ten area, if we'd have put a roof on it, we would be getting that every year. We would also, we could also bid for other things. While this wouldn't be economically feasible and it wouldn't go on forever, we could have put on the state high school football championships now and then. Couldn't do it every year. They're moving the state high school championships this year to Columbus, the Horseshoe. They're going to have 10,000 people there to watch in a 100,000-seat stadium. That just doesn't work.
Atmosphere doesn't.
Yes, it wasn't. We had the perfect atmosphere in Stark County, but anyway, there's the next brilliant promoter will find out what's next, what will be the next. Yeah.
The only thing that I could respond to Dan in that about the dome on the stadium.
Okay.
Is that engineers tell me and so forth, the price tag for putting that on is enormous.
You mean to do it now or to do it then?
Either. Mm-hmm. In that,
I would think it's impossible now, but.
Well, anything's possible. Again, you come down to a common denominator. It starts with C and ends with H, C-A-S-H. The bedrock, the stability of the of the ground, the earth. In that area, being next to a good-sized body of water, as we know, it's not like you're building something, say, in the New York area. Mm-hmm. You've got all kinds of bedrock, a very stable ground. Now, all that can be overcome, but it's a question of money. And with all the dreaming that you might do about we could get that game here all the time and so forth, there must be very good minds that are trying to figure that out, but they said, we just can't put that package together at this time. It's just, we can't attract the investment.
Too bad they couldn't have put it in a different area where the ground is more stable.
That's right.
It wouldn't have to be there.
Correct. Although a lot of the downtown ground, it doesn't end necessarily on Superior Avenue, that going south, but it's not just not as stable as it should, as is needed to do that. Because they said the weight that you need to have a dome stadium is.
Okay.
Now, by the way, I am not an engineer, although I was pre-engineering in college, but it's not. But it's just too much.
Well, maybe the next time we get together, we can talk about the era of the air races in Cleveland.
Oh yeah.
We missed that one.
No, yeah, I had a party in a plane.
Oh, did you really?
I got some guy talked me into putting some money into it. And I got to the, I was a little bit late.
A racing plane?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's a small time thing, but I remember I was a little bit late in getting there, and we were watching the planes go around the pilings.
Yeah.
I said, whoa, what's that car that plane? He is really slow. I mean, you can tell that, Jack, congratulations, that's our plane.
Well, Jack, once again, it has been fun talking to you. Boy, you know, we haven't wasted our 76 years. We've covered a lot of ground, at least in the last 50 minutes we have.
Absolutely. And, there's a lot that we didn't talk about,
that's
too,
right. Uh-huh. Okay, Jack.
I always look forward to the next time to speak.
Okay,
with
our guest today was Jack Herrick, who is closely associated with tennis, world champion squash? Mm-hmm. World champion squash in the Squash Hall of Fame, in the Cleveland Sports Hall of Fame. And always a pleasure to spend an hour or so with you, Jack Herrick.